Good morning. I'm Madonna Guy, and this is The Natural Alternative. Welcome. I am so delighted to have Israeli engineer Shimon Janowitz with us here this morning. Shimon has been working with a collaborative group of people around the world looking at the bioweapons being injected. He's found worms, circuitry, Bluetooth signals all coming from the jabs, which are turning people potentially into cyborgs. Dr. Janowitz is an electrical engineer and independent researcher based in Israel. He has done extensive research on the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic. He argues the Spanish flu pandemic was caused by injections administered to prevent meningitis. Dr. Janowitz has not had any COVID injections. However, he has seen these nanostructures in samples in his own blood. He is unwell as a result. Dr. Janowitz says, "It is my opinion that we are in a genocidal war. The rulers of the world have declared war on the citizens of the world with the intent of wiring them to the artificial intelligence, AI-based cloud, or killing them." Welcome, Shimon.
So, nanotechnology, it's in the injections. We know that. We have all the evidence. So, what is basically nanotechnology? Well, quite simple. Basically, it's something that comprises two things. One is some material in form of nanoparticles or hydrogel, or packaged, either packaged in very small capsules or just floating material, or even atoms and molecules, or DNA, large molecules.
Can we chat about hydrogel for a minute? The first time that I heard that, it was with Dr. Carrie Madej in about mid to late 2020, and she was talking about the hydrogel as being one of the technologies that will make it able to be non needle injectables and things like that. And then the more we've discussed the hydrogel, it seems so much huger than I had ever imagined.
Hydrogel is one of several methodologies in nanotechnology. And no, pretty much you can inject it. But you can also maybe aerosolize it, and
right,
then it can be inhaled maybe. So it depends upon the wish of the people who made the technology, how fast they wanted to get into the body and where do they want it to go. So if it's aerosolized, well, it can go to the eyes, the skin, the ears, and the nasal cavities, and the lungs, and the bronchial tubes. Right? This is, but from the skin, things. There are materials that know how to get into the blood from the lungs or from the nose, the mucosa, and the skin.
But is it just traveling freely around the body, or is it designed to go to specific areas? Or do we not know that yet?
That's a very good question. So if it's being injected, right, and then things become much more dramatic. Because injection, is just a poisoned needle, very sharp and pinpointed at some, the deltoid muscle or something such as this. And then you can inject, well, it's a low quantity, maybe half a cc or so, or even less. But half a cc can contain billions of particles if they are small enough. Now, in that case, You have all the nice material in there, focusing in just one small location in the body, as opposed to, for example, if you're exposed to fumes or aerosol or something, then you're engulfed, your entire body is engulfed, and you need totally different concentrations.
I can hear you, Shimon. I just do this Andy Warhol thing occasionally.
Is this on purpose?
No, not at all, not at all.
Yeah, very Andy Warhol-like.
Yeah, so all this nanotechnology.
Oh, here you are. You're
yes.
back.
Yes.
There are two possibilities. The most obvious one is obviously that from the, if you're sprayed with this or you absorb fumes or aerosol, it goes pretty much to all over the body. And in case of injection, this is also possible, but there are some things that they can do to maybe steer this into certain locations that are of particular interest. So, for example, just one simple trick that you can do is, just incorporate some magnetic, very small magnetic particles in this yet small hydrogel. And then by applying some kind of magnetic force, you can have it, you can steer it, right? And navigate. And then there are also other possibilities, such as what is the composition of this material? And by changing the composition, you can have it have a larger affinity to certain tissues and organs. So it can, go in your circulation, but then it can lock in on some area of interest. And we don't have all the answers. We don't know how they made this exactly, but we know that there is hydrogel in there. We cannot resolve very small particles in optical microscopy, which is what we are mostly doing, because the particles are so small, they are smaller than the wavelength of visible light. So an optical microscope using visible light cannot resolve single particles, but when there's a swarm of millions or billions or trillions of these, you can certainly see a cloud, right? A muddy cloud of some material. So we can resolve the cloud. Now, if we want to examine the individual particles, and assuming that we don't want to believe the official narrative that they are telling us, then it would take a much more advanced lab, maybe exotic kinds of electron microscopy. And then the preparation of the sample becomes a lot more complicated and requires different skills. And also electron microscopy is a whole different ballgame, entirely different ballgame. And you can, because it focuses on things that are so small, you can easily miss the bigger picture, or you can
Right.
focus on something. You can focus on something that you think is significant, but it's so, it could potentially be insignificant relative to the bigger picture. And so, electron microscopy has its problems.
Yes,
and they're taking full advantage of this. Plus, the fact that they just don't give us access to vials.
As we know, people like Dr. Anna Mahalsia, they're not allowed to look at the ingredients in the vaccines in America, it's a violation of law. So she's, So we're very lucky to have you and Matt and Dr. Nixon all, you know, working so hard. With the electron microscopy, because obviously we've got Antoinette Agati in our group and she's got an electron microscope. So one of the problems that I'm understanding is that graphene oxide is made from, is it carbon and oxygen? Or not quite?
So you jumped straight to graphene oxide.
Oh, okay, sorry.
That's nice. No, it's fine. So we suspect that, there could be graphene oxide in there as nanoparticles. And I haven't talked about the nanorobots yet. But, yeah, there could be graphene oxide, and it could be put in there in very small particle nanoparticles of that graphene oxide. And it can be itself encapsulated in this hydrogel. So the hydrogel that it itself comprises nanoparticles, lipids, you know, and some other things, could, just be a delivery system for some content. So it's a payload and transporting mechanism. This is a graphene oxide. And specifically relating to your question, graphene is just an exotic form of carbon, right? It's graphene basically is a monolayer of carbon atoms. Carbon has some exotic forms in nature. A diamond, for example, is carbon. And the diamond is pure carbon. And if you take, for example, if you have a piece of glass and a pure diamond, and you want to know which is which, all you have to do is just take a lighter and try to burn the two. The glass would not burn, whereas a diamond being made of pure carbon would evaporate to carbon dioxide, would burn immediately and just turn to vapor. This is how we can test if a diamond is a diamond. Of course, you lose the diamond, but at least you know that it was. So graphene is some exotic form of one layer of carbon atoms that are arranged in hexagonal shape. And then graphene oxide is simply the oxygenated form of this graphene. Now, both have their uses. Graphene as pure carbon in this monolayer sheets, sometimes used for some applications. And graphene oxide is another form, the oxygenated form, and is used in different things. So graphene, for example, if you want to create structures by nanotechnology, it makes more sense to use graphene oxide, because graphene sort of relies on the fact that it's a monolayer. It's more restricted. Graphene oxide is much more amiable. You can do more things with it.
And how do we know there's do we know there's graphene oxide in the jabs?
That's an excellent question. So again, using just optical microscopy and looking at something, we don't know what it's made of. We can't tell the composition. What has been done in the world, not just by Antoinette Agati, other people, they have used spectroscopy, different spectroscopy techniques. Some electron microscopes are also equipped with something called EDS, which is while you're scanning the image for with the electron microscope, you can you can just point to the field of view, and then there is a built-in mechanism that shoots X-rays into that area, and there is a fluorescence, and then the spectrum of the fluorescence can tell us about the chemical composition. So yes. People notice that we have, for example, if you do this with a sample, you can come up with what's called a spectrogram or a spectrograph, and this has peaks corresponding to different elements.
Right.
So if you had, for example, iron or copper, or so you would have spikes in that correspond to iron, and so the system knows from the energy of the spectrograph what components it contains. Now we've noticed that the majority of the samples contain mostly carbon and oxygen.
Yep.
So this could also be, I don't know, lipids. Lipids are also, lipids are mostly carbon and hydrogen, so not so much oxygen, and therefore we suspect it's not lipids. By the way, hydrogen is very difficult to detect, being the smallest molecule in the universe. We always have a spike of hydrogen, and we just ignore it because it doesn't tell us much. It could come from other sources. But our colleagues who do have these spectroscopy tools notice that we see mostly carbon and oxygen. So again, I can't say that it's graphene oxide, but I could say that it's carbon species oxide, right? It could be graphite oxide. It could be carbon dioxide, but carbon dioxide is a gas, so very unlikely. We see solids. So there are many carbon species, but graphene oxide is one of the most exotic of them. And we suspect that this is it because, first, the evidence suggests, carbon and oxygen, no diamonds in there. We can detect diamonds.
Ducks.
And diamonds don't contain oxygen. Graphene oxide is simply the graphite. But any carbon species oxide is possible. And what's common to all of these species is carbon is an abundant substance in nature in general. And this graphene oxide has a lot of exotic capabilities. For example, it is ideally suited to be used in nanotechnology. Hence, we say graphene oxide, but if someone proves to me that it's not graphene oxide, it's graphite oxide, okay. Still the same. The same applies. This is what we know is creating the structures that
yes.
later develop from the vials. And these structures are big enough, sometimes very big, to be visible in an optical microscope. Sometimes they are so big that they are bigger than the field of view. Some of them could be 1 millimeter, and then you can, if you look at the glass slide, you can see them with the naked eye. If one does the work properly and uses a clean environment so that it's not just dust that has settled on the sample, then this is called self-assembly.
And this is the scary bit, the self-assembly. Yeah, this is the scary bit.
Yeah, and you mentioned earlier self-replication. There is that too, at least in theory. But this is a much more theoretical yet and advanced in self-assembly. So in self-assembly, you have a lot of material and you have nanorobots going in the middle and mediating the assembly of these separate components into a structure.
Yes.
This is called self-assembly, and we have nanomaterials and nanorobots doing this self-assembly. And self-replication is something more advanced. It means that the nanorobots are capable of constructing new nanorobots that were not there originally.
Oh my goodness.
So the thing with self-assembly is you know that the process finishes at some point, right? You have some limited amount of material and you have a limited number of nanorobots. Now, assuming there is a caveat there too, because again, carbon could, you know, it's all over the place. We all composed of carbon. So it could also suck carbon from other places. And but the classical methodology is you have some amount of material and some nanorobots, and then this determines when the self-assembly would finish, when you've exhausted the material.
Yes.
With self-replication, what can happen is that there would not be a limit, not be a hard stop to this process, and it could continue more and more, absorbing more material and continuing the assembly with material that wasn't there originally. And then we don't know when the process would end. Theoretically, you know, it could continue in the start in the body, it could then shed and continue in a petri dish or in a lab or in nature. You can have the entire earth swarming with this is very dangerous.
Yes.
So this is why I think that it's at this point more theoretical, but you know, I wouldn't put this past them.
No, and Karen Kingston has certainly, with her research into the patents, she certainly has talked about one of those things, self-replication or self, which one? One of them she says is definitely in the patents associated with the vaccines.
Probably self-assembly. I don't know which patent you're referring to, but self-assembly is the basic of nanotechnology, whereas self-replication is the more theoretical and speculative part. We don't know if they have self-replication capabilities. Maybe they do. Now, so yeah, Karen Kingston is doing great work, but we need to remember that if some technology is mentioned in a patent, this does not yet say that this patent is actually implemented anywhere.
Right.
You know, there are many patents that, you know, that describe some technology or some mechanism that is not implemented anywhere. And this is quite confusing because for example, we can have 100 patents, of which maybe one is actually being used anywhere in a system, whereas, you know, there are, I think, many patents that remain in paper form, so no one has done anything with them.
Right.
The advantage of actually doing the testing in the tools that we have, the advantage is that we can actually see, as best we can, what is being implemented. And then if we find the corresponding patent, so much the better. And sometimes, you know, There is this strategy, Madonna. You know, some people don't want to publish a patent,
Right.
so they prefer, for example, you know, because a patent. What is a patent good for? It's good for publicity, and it's good for giving you some intellectual property protection. For maybe 20 years, I think. I'm not sure. Well, it keeps changing. And so if someone copies your technology, you can sue them in court. That's what Right. patents are good for. Another strategy would be to just not disclose the information and hide it so that no one can copy it. So patents are limited. And there is, in addition to patents, we have simple scientific papers, of which patents are a subset,
right?
So we need to also look at the scientific literature. Sometimes, you know, people don't want a patent; they just want to share the information with the scientific community, and then it's a scientific paper. And you can find many interesting things there too.
Yes, and that's been part of the challenge as well, because there's decades now, isn't there, of research associated with these things. So it's not like
Indeed.
They made it up in 2020.
No, yeah. I think that I had a presentation to the group, and I showed some paper that described, for example, from 2010, describing 2 decades of development of these, you know, we're talking about some filament structures, sometimes called Morgellons or Morgellons. I'm never sure how it should be pronounced. And there's a, you know, or they can be described as, you know, just one-dimensional filaments.
Yes.
And then you have a paper saying, we describe 2 decades of development and deployment of these things.
And deployment.
And it's 2010. So here in 2023, we know that it's 3 decades already. Exactly that.
And when you mention Morgellons or Morgellons, I say it confidently. So do you believe at this point that it is being aerosolized?
I think that with respect to Morgellons or Morgellons, I think they have certainly been aerosolized, as this particular paper surveying the decades of research implies. And not only have there been aerosolized, but some people were infected by them. But this was a more crude and basic technology at its early stages. Still, it can do a lot of damage. And I don't think that these Morgellons of the past are in the current generation of injectables. But newer versions of them certainly are, as well as other things. So Morgellons could be, you know, just a filament or string-like structure. Now we can see two-dimensional, even three-dimensional structures being self-assembled. And so Morgellons, for example, is you know, is one of the things that we can ask about. Do they, in addition to self-assembly, do they self-replicate? That is, can they grow into larger structures than what there was originally enough material for?
Right.
And in the case of Morgellons, maybe they could, because they could grow inside people and become much larger.
I listened to one whistleblower about Morgellons, and he was, once again, who knows whether or not he was telling the truth, but he seemed to be an ex-NASA person who was talking about the technology that they were dropping to aerosolize would target specific organs in the body with the idea that, but then of course people were getting the little, you know, fragments coming out of their skin. So, you know, they just get called they're drug addicts or say they're addicted to meth or something rather than having any. And thinking back, you know, because I've been a naturopath for nearly 30 years, I can think of a couple of people that potentially might have had something like that. Like I can't sort of think of too many. So maybe we've been lucky here in Australia for a little while. Doesn't feel so lucky these days. Feels like we're being hammered a bit. But yeah, it's so you've had a special interest in Morgellons over the years?
Well, when I started researching nanotechnology, this is the first thing that I encountered. And this was of special interest already before the deployment of the injectables. And this is a very interesting story because people all over the world started looking, you know, at into swabs, you know, these very long sticks being shoved into people's noses and face masks. And they saw things that looked like Morgellons, especially, you know, and these things behaved very strangely. So the injectables were deployed at the beginning of 2021, whereas the face masks and the swabs were deployed in the beginning of 2020, although we know that they have been shipping worldwide long before that. They have prepared the stock of these. And so we know that there were Morgellons in there. And this is not good, is it? Right? You wear a face mask that is said to provide some protection for you, and this face mask could infect you, your lungs and your bronchi tubes and so on with all sorts of evil stuff.
Yeah.
Same with swabs. In fact, so currently we are mostly focused on the injectables, but if we go back to the swabs, you know, that marked the beginning of this crazy, insane period of, that we now live in Australia, in Israel, my country, everywhere. Well, it started with, you know, just shoving these sticks into people's noses. And if you have some technology that can be used as a... so these Morgellons and hydrogels, many other nanotechnology structures are just payload delivery systems, right? So you put that so close to you, to one's brain, as far into the nasal cavities as it would go, and then such Morgellons could crawl into one's brain. This is not very not good news, is it?
No, absolutely not. I saw yesterday that the youngest ever person to be diagnosed with Alzheimer's, maybe 21 years old or something like that. And I remembered Peter McCullough early on in the piece after the injectables started saying some of his young clients, he was talking in his 40s and 50s and 60s, were coming in with early onset dementia after the injectables. And that's part of what made him stand back and have a look at them, thank goodness. So it's been a long road.
Yeah, personally, if you mention Peter McCullough, so... You know, he's a very prominent medical doctor. And unfortunately, he's not very vocal. He doesn't understand anything about nanotechnology, does he?
Because... No, he's only vocal about the myocarditis and issues.
So
yes.
There, you know, there are several prominent medical doctors. And this is not medical, Madonna. You know, this is technology. These people don't understand. They don't have the qualifications to comprehend what's going on.
Ryan Cole and Robert Malone and, you know, some really, very prominent people not owning it. What are they doing? They're not owning that. They're not admitting to it. Mike Yeadon, you know, there's some really intelligent guys out there.
Yeah, some are just outright denying the existence of it. And this is not only worrying, it's also surprising, because yes. My understanding is that there are instances where medical doctors should just be humbled and listen to the people, the scientists, the people who understand the technology, and try to learn something once in their lives, and then go and, you know, if one is, for example, a pathologist, it would be nice for that someone, you know, just to learn, absorb the knowledge, and then go look for it in autopsies.
Yes.
Instead of just, you know, going upstate and declaring that hasn't been found in yeah. the vials. Are you, okay, I don't want to go too much into that. The thing is that a lot in this scandemic, not just the nanotechnology, starting from the swabs, the face mask, and the PCR test, is not related to medicine in any way, shape, or form.
Yes.
And it is not up to medical doctors to take ownership of this. That would be wrong. And unfortunately, many of them are doing just that, and this is misleading.
Yeah, it's also frustrating because it is an evil agenda. Like, they're injecting this stuff. And now, of course, Bill Gates is standing up and saying that he's going to also put a lot of money into injectable chips and things like that. And I'm thinking, is that just another distraction? They're already doing it. They're already injecting us. And I sort of keep hearing these headlines and thinking, yeah, you're just saying that, but it's a distraction.
We think it is, yes. Instead of injecting people with chips, they can nowadays inject people with the nanotechnology to assemble the chips in situ inside the body. You don't have to inject a whole chip, even though the chip could be very small. You can inject much smaller structures or technology into people and have this technology create the chip for you,
yeah,
or many chips. And this is, you know, especially with our colleagues Matt Taylor and Dr. David Nixon, we've been looking a lot at these structures that, to us they look like electronic circuitry, and they are self-assembling, under the microscope. We have video footage of this. So, with all due respect to Bill Gates, with all respect to Bill Gates, I don't think that we should believe him.
No.
Right? So, he's the guy who said normalcy only returns when we've, vaccinated.
Injected every man, woman, and child. Yeah,
they pretty much injected everybody, and then did normalcy return? No. And then there's, the World Economic Forum people.
Yeah.
Headed by Klaus Schwab. And they say, what do you mean normalcy? Never. We have a great reset coming up. No, it would be an illusion to expect that things would go back to how they were before. Yeah. So now, I don't think we should. We should certainly pay attention to what they're saying, but not for the purpose of just accepting it.
Yeah. And what do you think the end goal is? Have you come up with some thoughts about what you think the end goal is?
Unfortunately or fortunately, we don't need to speculate a lot, because both Klaus Schwab, he already published a book called The Fourth Industrial Revolution, right? And now he is assisted by my compatriot, historian Oddly enough, Yuval Noah Harari. All right, and they're
Creepy human
opening.
being.
Sorry?
He's a very creepy human being.
Who, Yuval Noah Harari
Oh,
or
well,
Klaus
both of
Schwab?
them, but yes.
Both of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
nice observation there.
Ugh.
So they openly discuss, you know, just hacking the human brain, the human spirit, the human cognition, you know, just changing what it means to be human. We know because they are telling us. The end goal is to replace the humans in us with some cyborg entity and connect the cyborg entity to their cloud computers with what else? Electromagnetic communication networks. And then we have the Internet of Things and the Internet of Bodies. This is very creepy indeed. So this is the I don't know to what extent or where they are at the moment. I'm sure they're quite successful at disrupting the behavior and the brain health of people, because many people are feeling this effect. And we also, you know, we do the live blood analysis in our blood, and we see the structures in our blood. And so there is this desire to just disrupt the normal activity of the brain, and then it has significant consequences on what we all feel and how healthy we are. And then there is the actual hacking, right, as in the capability of capability of reading from the brain and writing thoughts directly to the brain. Maybe they're not there yet, but they're certainly at the point where they can interfere or mess up with the normal operation of our bodies and brains and cause a lot of problems.
Well, certainly Yuval claims that, was that a couple of years ago, he said that people already think that they're voting for someone and they think that they're choosing something, but they're not. So he certainly claims that they're already at the space where they can control our thoughts and our mind.
There are other means other than nanotechnology. The most obvious one would be, a very advanced propaganda machine speaking out of mainstream media.
Yes.
For example, if they want most, not all, fortunately, most of the world population to think that there is a outrageous, terrible, disastrous pandemic raging out there, they can do that. They've proven to us that they can. Just,
yes,
you know, say it enough times on mainstream media, and people would not only would they start believing it, they would then later on line up to be jabbed with these injectables,
yes,
that are actually accelerating this agenda.
Yes, absolutely. And with the, so connecting it, oh, I was wondering about the hive mind. Is that connected to the Internet of Things and the Internet of Bodies, the hive mind concept?
Yeah, the hive mind, I think that, you know, just referring to bees in hives, once they've achieved the capability, which I'm not sure they have achieved already, of, you know, just controlling everyone's thoughts and reading and writing from afar through the wireless electromagnetic communication networks, then if they have achieved that, then so they can control individual human beings. If they can do that, not just disrupt, but actually control them, then at the back end, at the artificial intelligence computer network, they can connect people together and control them simultaneously, and then things would appear as though there is a, you know, we behave like hives, sorry, like bees in hives, and they can, if the first target has been achieved of controlling individuals from afar, then you control many individuals, and then you can have a hive effect, and this is what you're referring to, I think.
Yeah. Yes, and certainly mainstream media seems to have done that to most Australians the last few years. It's all very bizarre.
So, yeah, so the propaganda machine is already doing that. And, you know, there are mind games and psyops and all these things that can, to a great extent, control people. And there is even, you know, without nanotechnology, there is even, for example, the electromagnetic radiation. We know, because it's been studied long before COVID, the COVID era, that it can do things that not only are unhealthy for the human body, but they could also disrupt normal brain functioning and so on. So I don't know. I think that they have researched for a long time, just influencing and affecting and controlling and modifying people's behavior by just electromagnetic signals.
Mm.
But that is not enough for them.
Yes.
We know they want to go further and be able to read your thoughts directly. And this is different than just, influencing your behavior.
Yeah. And we know that electromagnetic radiation actually affects the body in relation to the injectables too, don't we? Like that's been shown to be the case underneath the microscopes?
Yes. Yes. So I think Matt Taylor was first to observe that, he took footage of something that looked like electronic circuitry undergoing self-assembly with his microscope, and then he used a router, and just a domestic router, put it near the sample, and you could see that the self-assembly was speeding up by a lot if there was the radiation from the electromagnetic radiation from the router affecting the sample. And then when he removed the router, the self-assembly not only stopped, but it went backwards. There was the structures dissolved suddenly. It was very, very surprising. And then Dr. David Nixon repeated and replicated these results. And I did too. So I was I didn't have a good enough microscope to begin with. So we know not only with respect to electronic circuitry, but the other structures,
yeah,
such as the ribbons, Morgellons, filaments, tubes, whatever, the injectables seem to interact and derive energy from electromagnetic radiation. This energy then speeds up the self-assembly process. And it could also somehow, so they are very advanced, could also initiate a disassembly process. It shows that they are very advanced. And so disassembly in particular is not less dangerous than assembly. Of course, when things assemble, then it's not good. Then you have things in your body that you don't want. But
yes,
if you have disassembly, there are the risks, for example, of them being able to dissolve evidence that was in you, for example. That's one thing, one aspect. The other thing is, suppose you have structures like synthetic worm-looking structures, and suppose these are loaded with some chemicals. These chemicals could be drugs. You see a lot of scientific papers saying, we can save humanity. How's that? Easily, we can build these drug delivery system, and then we can send them straight into your cancerous tumor and open them up and spill the toxins into that tumor and destroy the tumor. That's very noble. And there is this euphemism in most of these papers. They don't discuss just killing people. They're discussing saving people by killing their tumors. But if they can kill your tumor, they can kill your brain or your heart as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this vis-a-vis myocarditis, all the other nonsense that is being mentioned. So I don't think this is myocarditis. This is just simply destroying organs.
Right.
This could be, just random. I mean, some toxins lurking in your body, and with some people, they might be landing in the brain, destroying the brains, causing dementia, and that for others, it could be destroying the kidneys, the lungs, or the heart. Or there could be some steering mechanism, which I tend to think it's easily, in electrical engineering, all you have to do is you have the infrastructure, right? The towers are sending the electromagnetic signals. Just use it to steer the structures to where you want them to go. Then send the command to open up and release the payload, and then voila, you have what you wanted.
Yes. Now, we know there's shedding because people who, well, either there's shedding or they're aerosolizing it or they're getting into it in our food or something. So we know that people who are uninjected are having a lot of the similar things going on in their blood as the injected. I checked out my blood Sunday a week ago and I was so disappointed. I had lots of things in there I did not want, but I had seen, I was out at a dam. We'd camped overnight. It was a perfectly blue sky. And I started seeing some shenanigans in the sky. And sure enough, it was cloudy by lunchtime. And I had a look at my blood and there was all sorts of stuff in there. I was like, God damn it. It was very interesting. Now, it may have had nothing to do with it, but...
Do you do a lot of microscopy? I guess you are as a naturopath and healer.
I started doing microscopy about 15 years ago. I've only just got the same camera that David has. So it's mm-hmm. literally just been hooked up a week ago. So I was the first person that I had checked.
Right.
So yeah,
I was the first person I had checked too. It's always easy, right, to check yourself, and then you spread the word, and people start checking themselves and others, and suddenly we know that the majority of the unjabbed have these structures.
Yes.
Now, so initially we didn't know. Was this a result of chemtrails, aerosols from the sky? Maybe. But then we started getting the information that I showed there is this particular paper that shows the case of a vial of injectable matter dropping on the floor somewhere, and then people in the same building got eye and skin irritations from the fumes. So this is volatile. So I've discussed that. I can show the paper, but it's if you want, just tell me. But basically, these things are volatile. So, and we had the anecdotal evidence. People were saying, I was near a Jap person, I didn't, later I felt sick.
Yes.
Or, you know, I had sexual intercourse with that injected person, and then I had some bleeding.
Yes.
Abnormal bleed. Many anecdotal things that we didn't know, are they true or not true? Now there's plausibility that they are indeed true, because if this is volatile and it creates fumes, and I've shown this on my latest microscopy work, that the injectable matter is volatile and it evaporates and can condensate back, and this is an ideal mechanism.
Yeah.
For
and how have you been when you've been dealing with the injectables? Like, how have you been feeling yourself?
Well, to begin with, I was testing samples covered by a cover slip, so there was some protection, and I didn't, I wasn't too concerned. But my colleagues, Matt Taylor and Dr. David Nixon, when they found the what we think are chips or electronic circuitry, they used you know, a bulkier sample without a cover slip. I was asking them, did you have any adverse event? Because I did hear things from other people who looked at these materials and did not feel so well afterwards. And Matt and David Nixon told me, no, you know, apart from the excitement and the some you know adrenaline rush associated with examining these advanced technology materials, we didn't feel too bad. Now, it could be, we know that there is great variability between batches, so it could be that my batch was particularly toxic, because for me, when I eventually tried examining samples without a cover slip, the eye irritation was so obvious, and the yeah, the symptoms that followed were unmistakable. This thing is designed to create shedding. Now, this is not to say that they cannot aerosolize this from the sky as well, but it just goes to show that what the anecdotal evidence of people saying, I could feel it, has roots in the actual testing that we do. We find the thing that can explain just that.
Yes. And which ingredients do you suspect are shedding?
Shedding, well, it is a problematic term, because shedding refers to something that goes from one person to another person. Now, initially, we can see something going from a glass slide to a person. So this is not called shedding. This is, how would we call this?
Infection? Transfection?
Infection, transfection. This incident in this paper in Thailand that described a vial that dropped and snapped on the floor, and all the people bad reactions, adverse reactions in their eyes and the skin and so on. So this shows that this thing creates fumes. Now, by the very fact that something is volatile, it means that if you ingest it, you can emit it.
Right.
And this is why we smell alcohol of people who have been drinking alcohol, because alcohol is volatile.
Right.
Fortunately, alcohol has a distinct smell, but there are many other fumes that we cannot smell.
Yes.
Only in the aftermath can we discover that, oops, We are very unwell. So I think answering your question, what sheds or what, in fact, I think that the there were obviously materials there that were designed to evaporate, and maybe not just materials, maybe a whole structure such as drops of hydrogel. Now, we need to do, or I need to do more testing to find out exactly what is evaporating. But again, this is a problem.
Yes.
Because ideally, we would like two things. One would be uninterrupted access to vials, which we don't have.
Yes.
And as you mentioned, in America, you know, it's a criminal offense to do this.
Yeah.
This is unimaginable, you know, something that is being injected to maybe the entire population of the world, and you cannot, it's illegal to exist. Wow.
Yeah.
Really. And the other thing that we would like is, you know, uninterrupted access to labs with the most advanced and suitable equipment, maybe hoods, you know, that would protect us from not only hoods, but also other instrumentation, like something like we discussed before, spectroscopy tools and so on. So this is a problem. We are working like in some sort of underground fashion with sometimes with not the most advanced tools and with very limited access to vials that, you know, we happen to find lying on the ground somewhere. We cannot access the storage facility and just pick any batch we want. This is, it's not happening.
Okay. Yes, so would